Hi, I'm Spider Robinson, and you've become inextricably entangled in Spider on the Web 28.
Help me! Help me!
Being podcast, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. I'll read you an excerpt from my novel Mind Killer in just a bit, but I'm opening this week with a track I had the honor of recording with the great Amos Garrett some years ago, from my CD, my one and only CD, Belaboring the Obvious. This track is called The Drunkard Song. Well, a swelling wealthy relative of mine had up and died, and I received $100,000 from the will. So a friend and I decided to convert this into liquid form, the better our esophagi to fill. So we started in the city, had a drink in every shitty little gin mill, and that's really quite a few. And then this cabbie up in Harlem took us clear across the river into Brooklyn, where he joined us in a brew. Now we was leaving trust a trifle by the time we hit Astoria at 80 miles an hour in reverse. But that was nothing to the weaving that we did as we was leaving, and from time to time it got a little worse. Well, had nothing like drinking up a windfall, baby, we were drunker than a monkey with his skin full. Goddamn drunk in the sandfall, and I believe I ain't sober yet. Well, across the city line, we was feeling mighty fine, sucking whiskey and whistling at the girls. The next saloon we try, somebody wants to punch my eye. He objected to my long, shaggy curls. His fist come out of orbit, knocked me clear across the bar, but I was pretty drunk. I didn't really care. In fact, I was sorely disappointed when the coppers hit the joint just as I was making my rebuttal with a chair. Ah, but the coppers come a cropper, cause I made it to the crapper and departed by a ventilator shaft. Met both of my buddies out in the alley as they run out through the galley. We ran and ran and laughed and laughed and laughed. There's nothing like drinking up a windfall, baby. We're drunker than a monkey with a skin full. So goddamn drunk in a sample, and I believe I ain't sober yet. Pour me one, Amos. Drunker than a monkey with his skin full. Goddamn drunk in the sandbar, and I believe I ain't sober yet. Let me see now. About halfway out of Levittown, we got our second wind, and the dump so down, and I didn't make you laugh. So I had another mug, my buddy had a jug, and cabbie had another pitcher and a half. Well, when we got to Suffolk County, he was going into overdrive. The word had spread, and crowds began to form. We drank our way from Jericho along 110 to the Merrick Road, just a boozing and a singing of a storm. I lost my buddy in the cabbie in the Hamptons somewhere. We was all just drunker than it's possible to be. Finally come a time, I didn't have another guide. I sat on Montauk Point and I wept into the sea. But there's nothing like drinking of a windfall, baby. We were drunker than a monkey with his skin full. We were so goddamn drunk as a sandbar, and I believe I ain't sober yet. Well, ain't nothing like drinking of a windfall, baby. We were drunker than a monkey with his skin full. Goddamn drunk as a sandbar, and I believe I ain't sober yet. That was Jerry Adolph pretending to fall off his own drum kit. Still cracks me up after all these years. Based on that track was the great Nuke Nukem, lead guitar unmistakably the astonishing Amos Garrett, piano was the incredible Mike Kraber, who you probably know from K.D. Lang albums and a dozen others. Producer was Danny Cassavant, who also filled in a little on guitar here and there. And let me see who else. Oh, I must remember to mention that it was recorded by the Paul Baker at Baker Street Studios in North Vancouver, and it was thanks to Paul's generosity that I was able to just now perform for you a one-time-only special live version of that track. After we recorded the CD, Paul was kind enough to give me all four tracks with the vocals scrubbed. So basically, I've got Amos Garrett in a box I can carry around and sing with. And so tonight I'm going to be giving you all four of the tunes from my CD, but revisited with new vocals, mixed live right here in my office at Tottering on the Brink. Whether this will seem in retrospect to have been a good idea or not, I couldn't say, but what the hell, it's unquestionably an historically rare artifact. Without further ado, then, here's another of those songs, the second or I believe third song that I ever wrote at the age of 17, so long ago that I had the idea existential angst and despair were sexually attractive to young women. Or so I apparently hoped, because I wrote a song about how miserable I was and how great it would be to have a little company with that. I like this recording of it, at least, because it happens to contain what I honestly believe is one of Amos Garrett's very finest guitar solos of all time. I got lucky and caught lightning in a bottle. You'll know it when you get to it. Here, without further ado, is all the aforementioned and me singing my song, Oblivion. I'm sitting in my car, playing my guitar. If you want my situation, I'm a nighttime man, catching everything I can. If you want my reputation, but I'm just marking time. I got the need to ramble on my mind. Oblivion seems to be my destination. Tell me, mama, don't you wanna go? The road is mighty long, and I've only got this song. If I feel the need for company, oh, oh dear Lord, I'd much prefer abroad. If you know a friendly one for me, that singing suits me just fine. That singing just won't keep me off the line. Oblivion seems to be my destination. Tell me, mama, don't you wanna go? No, you really should. Guarantee it'll make you feel good. Sitting here alone, with my feet up on the steering wheel, and I felt some blue. Try to pick a blue, somehow that's not the way I feel. Though the night is much too young, there's still 7 dozen songs I haven't sung. Oblivion's bound to be my destination. Hello, mama, don't you wanna go? I said, baby, don't you wanna go? Hello, mama, don't you wanna go? Oh my goodness, Amos Garrett can just sit down and do that anytime he feels like it. Damn. All right. Now, 2 months ago in Spider and the Web 20, I read you excerpts from all three of the novels represented in the Lifehouse Trilogy, the new hardcover omnibus just out from Bain Books. Because I was reading excerpts from all three books, each of them had to be very short. I ended up cutting at least one of them a hell of a lot shorter than I wanted to. I've decided to revisit it now, and I'll tell you why. I've been writing this stuff for, I don't even want to think about how many years now, and in all that time, I can think of maybe twice when I finished something and said, damn, that's good. If they don't like that, they're wrong. This is as good as I can do. This is good shit, and I know it. And in each case, I had horrible luck placing the story. It got so frustrating that I ended up writing the entire novel, Mind Killer, as an excuse to reprint the following chapter, which originally ran as a story called God is an Iron in Omni magazine. Omni was then the biggest, most expensive, best-selling science fiction magazine around, and I thought this was one of my best stories, and they gave it prominent treatment and a big splash on the cover, and it vanished without a trace. I didn't bring a single fan letter, didn't bring in any award nominations. It just vanished without a ripple. And I got so goddamn annoyed, I wrote the novel Mind Killer for an excuse to reprint it. Wrote a whole book around it just so I could use it again. I read you a short section 8 weeks ago, but here, without further ado, is the full text of God is an Iron. I smelled her before I saw her. Even so, the first sight was shocking. She was sitting in a tan, plastic-surfaced armchair, the kind where the front comes up as the back goes down. It was back as far as it would go. It was placed beside the large living room window, which was transparent. A plastic block table next to it held a clock, a dozen unopened packages of self-lighting Peter Jackson cigarettes, an empty ashtray, a full vial of cocaine, and a lamp with a bulb of at least 150 watts. It illuminated her with brutal clarity. She was naked. Her skin was the color of vanilla pudding. Her hair was in rats, her nails unpainted and untended, some overlong and some broken. There was dust on her. She sat in a ghastly sludge of feces and urine. Dried vomit was caked on her chin and between her breasts and down her ribs to the chair. These were only part of what I had smelled. The predominant odor was of fresh-baked bread. It is the smell of a person who is starving to death. The combined effluvia had prepared me to find a senior citizen paralyzed by a stroke or some such crisis. I judged her to be about 25 years old. I moved to where she could see me, and she did not see me. That was probably just as well, because I had just seen the two most horrible things. The first was the smile. They say that when the bomb went off at Hiroshima, some people's shadows were baked onto walls by it. I think that smile got baked on the surface of my brain in much the same way. I don't want to talk about that smile. The second horrible thing was the one that explained all the rest. From where I now stood, I could see a triple socket in the wall beneath the window. Into it were plugged the lamp, the clock, and her. I knew about wireheading, of course. I had lost a couple of acquaintances and one friend to the juice, but I had never seen a wirehead. It is by definition a solitary vice, and all the public usually gets to see is a sheeted figure being carried out to the wagon. The transformer lay on the floor beside the chair where it had been dropped. The switch was on, and the timer had been jiggered, so that instead of providing 1, 5, or 10, or 15 second jolt per hour, it allowed continuous flow. That timer is required by law on all juice rigs sold, and you need special tools to defeat it. Say, a nail file. The input cord was long and fell in crazy coils from the wall socket. The output cord disappeared beneath the chair, but I knew where it ended. It ended in the tangled snarl of her hair, at the crown of her head, in a mini-plug. The plug was snapped into a jack surgically implanted in her skull, and from the jack tiny wires snaked their way through the wet jelly to the hypothalamus, to the specific place in the medial forebrain bundle where the major pleasure center of her brain was located. She had sat there in total transcendent ecstasy for at least 5 days. I moved, finally. I moved closer, which surprised me. She saw me now, and impossibly the smile became a bit wider. I was marvelous. I was captivating. I was her perfect lover. I could not look at the smile. A small plastic tube ran from one corner of the smile, and my eyes followed it gratefully. It was held in place by small bits of surgical tape at her jaw, neck, and shoulder, and from there it ran in a lazy curve to the big 50-liter water cooler bottle on the floor. She had plainly meant her suicide to last. She had arranged to die of hunger rather than thirst, which would have been quicker. She could take a drink when she happened to think of it, and if she forgot, well, what the hell? My intention must have shown on my face, and I think she even understood it. The smile began to fade. That decided me. I moved before she could force her neglected body to react, whipped the plug out of the wall, and stepped back warily. Her body did not go rigid as if galvanized. It had already been so for many days. What it did was the exact opposite, and the effect was just as striking. She seemed to shrink. Her eyes slammed shut. She slumped. Well, I thought, it'll be a long day and a night before she can move a voluntary muscle again. And then she hit me before I knew she had left the chair, breaking my nose with the heel of one fist and bouncing the other off the side of my head. We cannoned off each other, and I managed to keep my feet. She whirled and grabbed the lamp. Its cord was stapled to the floor and would not yield, so she set her feet and yanked, and it snapped off clean at the base. In near total darkness, she raised the lamp on high and came at me, and I lunged inside the arc of her swing and punched her in the solar plexus. She said, "Guff," and went down. I staggered to a couch and sat down and felt my nose and fainted. I don't think I was out very long. The blood tasted fresh. I woke with a sense of terrible urgency. It took me a while to work out why. When someone has been simultaneously starved and unceasingly stimulated for days on end, it is not the best idea in the world to depress their respiratory center. I lurched to my feet. It was not completely dark. There was a moon somewhere out there. She lay on her back, arms at her sides, perfectly relaxed. Her ribs rose and fell in great slow swells. A pulse showed strongly at her throat. As I knelt beside her, she began to snore, deeply and rhythmically. I had time for second thoughts now. It seemed incredible that my impulsive action had not killed her. Perhaps that had been my subconscious intent. 5 days of wireheading alone should have killed her, never mind sudden cold turkey. I probed in the tangle of hair, found the empty jack. The hair around it was dry. If she hadn't torn the skin in yanking herself loose, it was unlikely that she had sustained any more serious damage within. I continued probing, found no soft places on the skull. Her forehead felt cool and sticky to my hand. The fecal smell was overpowering the baking bread now. There was no pain in my nose yet, but it felt immense and pulsing. I did not want to touch it or to think about it. My shirt was soaked with blood. I wiped my face with it and tossed it into a corner. It took everything I had to lift her. She was unreasonably heavy, and I say that having carried drunks and corpses. There was a hall off the living room, and all halls lead to a bathroom. I headed that way in a clumsy, staggering trot, and just as I reached the deeper darkness with my pulse at its maximum, my nose woke up and began screaming. I nearly dropped her then and clapped my hands to my face. The temptation was overwhelming. Instead, I whimpered like a dog and kept going. Childhood feeling. Runny nose you can't wipe. At each door I came to, I teetered on one leg and kicked it open, and the third one gave the right small room acoustic tile echo. The light switch was where they almost always are. I rubbed it on with my shoulder, and the room flooded with light. Large aquamarine tub, styrofoam recliner pillow at the head end, non-slip bottom. Aquamarine sink with ornate handles, cluttered with toiletries and cigarette butts and broken shards of mirror from the medicine cabinet above. Aquamarine commode, lid up and seat down. Brown throw rug, expensive. Scale, shoved back into a corner, covered with dust in which 2 footprints showed. I made a massive effort and managed to set her reasonably gently in the tub. I rinsed my face and hands of blood at the sink, ignoring the broken glass, and stuffed the bleeding nostril with toilet paper. I adjusted her head, fixed the chin strap. I held both feet away from the faucet until I had the water adjusted, and then left with one hand on my nose and the other beating against my hip in search of her liquor. There was plenty to choose from. I found some Metoxa in the kitchen. I took great care not to bring it near my nose, sneaking it up on my mouth from below. It tasted like burning lighter fluid and made sweat spring out on my forehead. I found a roll of paper towels, and on my way back to the bathroom, I used a great wad of them to swab most of the sludge off the chair and rug. There was a growing pool of water siphoning from the plastic tube, and I stopped that. When I got back to the bathroom, the water was lapping over her bloated belly and horrible tendrils were weaving up from beneath her. It took 3 rinses before I was satisfied with the body. I found a hose and spray under the sink that mated with the tub's faucet, and that made the hair easy. I had to dry her there in the tub. There was only 1 towel left, none too clean. I found a first aid spray that incorporated a good topical anesthetic and put it on the sores on her back and butt. I had located her bedroom on the way to the Metaxa. Wet hair slapped my arm as I carried her there. She seemed even heavier, as though she had become waterlogged. I eased the door shut behind me and tried the light switch trick again, and it wasn't there. I moved forward into a footlocker and lost her and went down amid multiple crashes, putting all my attention into guarding my nose. She made no sound at all, not even a grunt. The light switch turned out to be a pull chain over the bed. She was on her side, still breathing slow and deep. I wanted to punt her up onto the bed. My nose was a blossom of pain. I nearly couldn't lift her the third time. I was moaning with frustration by the time I had her on the left side on the king-size mattress. It was a big brass 4-poster bed and with satin sheets and pillowcases, all dirty. The blankets were shoved to the bottom. I checked her skull and pulse again, peeled up each eyelid, and found uniform pupils. Her forehead and cheeks still felt cool, so I covered her. Then I kicked the footlocker clear into the corner, turned out the light, and left her snoring like a chainsaw. Her vital papers and documents were in her study, locked in a strong box on the closet shelf. It was an expensive box, quite sturdy, and proof against anything short of nuclear explosion. It had a combination lock with all of 27 possible combinations. It was stuffed with papers. I laid her life out on her desk like a losing hand of solitaire and studied it with a growing frustration. Her name was Karen Schultz, but she used the name Karen Shaw, which I thought phony. She was 22. Divorced her parents at 14, uncontested, no fault. Since then she had been, at various times, waitress, secretary to a lamp salesman, painter, freelance typist, motorcycle mechanic, and unlicensed masseuse. The most recent paycheck stub was from The Hardcore, a massage parlor with a cut-rate reputation. It was dated almost a year ago. Her bank balance combined with paraphernalia I had found in the closet to tell me that she was currently self-employed as a tootlegger, a cocaine dealer. The richness of the apartment and furnishings told me that she was a foolish one. Even if the narcs missed her, very shortly the IRS was going to come down on her like a ton of bricks. Perhaps subconsciously, she had not expected to be around. Nothing there. I kept digging. She had attended community college for 1 semester as an art major and dropped out failing. She had defaulted on a lease 3 years ago. She had wrecked a car once and been shafted by her insurance company. Trivia. Only 1 major trauma in recent years. A year and a half ago, she had contracted out as host mother to a couple named Lombard Smythe. It was a pretty good fee. She had good hips and the right rare blood type. But 6 months into the pregnancy, they had caught her using tobacco and canceled the contract. She fought, but they had photographs. And better lawyers, naturally. She had to repay the advance and pay for the abortion, of course, and she got socked for court costs besides. It didn't make sense. To show clean lungs at the physical, she had to have been off cigarettes for at least 3 to 6 months. Why backslide with so much at stake? Like the minor traumas, it felt more like an effect than a cause. Self-destructive behavior. I kept looking. Near the bottom, I found something that looked promising. Both her parents had been killed in a car smash when she was 18. Their obituary was paperclipped to her father's will. That will was one of the most extraordinary documents I have ever read. I could understand an angry father cutting off his only child without a dime. But what he had done was worse. He had left all his money to the church, and to her, $100 the going rate. Damn it, that didn't work either. So their suicides don't wait 4 years. And they don't use such a garish method either. It devalues the tragedy. I decided it had to be either a very big and dangerous coke deal gone bad, or a very reptilian lover. No, not a coke deal. They would never have left her in her own apartment to die the way she wanted to. It could not be murder. Even the most unscrupulous wire surgeon needs an awake, consenting subject to place the wire correctly. A lover, then. I was relieved, pleased with my sagacity, and irritated as hell. I didn't know why. I chalked it up to my nose. It felt as though a large shark with rubber teeth was rhythmically biting it as hard as he could. I shoveled the papers back into the box, locked and replaced it, and went to the bathroom. Her medicine cabinet would have impressed a pharmacist. She had lots of allergies. It took me 5 minutes to find aspirin. I took four. I picked the largest shard of mirror out of the sink, propped it on the toilet tank, and sat backward on the seat. My nose was visibly displaced to the right, and the swelling was just hitting its stride. I removed the toilet tissue plug from my nostril, and it resumed bleeding. There was a box of Kleenex on the floor. I ripped it apart, took out all the tissues, and stuffed them into my mouth. Then I grabbed my nose with my right hand and tugged out to the left, simultaneously flushing the toilet with my left hand. The flushing coincided with the scream, and my front teeth met through the Kleenex. When I could see again, the nose looked straight and my breathing was unimpaired. When the bleeding stopped again, I gingerly washed my face and hands and left. A moment later, I returned. Something had caught my eye. It was the glass and toothbrush holder. There was only one toothbrush in it. I looked through the medicine cabinet again and noticed this time that there was no shaving cream, no razor, no masculine toiletries of any kind. All the prescriptions were in her name. I went thoughtfully to the kitchen, mixed myself a Preacher's Downfall by moonlight, and took it to her bedroom. The bedside clock said 5. I lit a match, moved the footlocker in front of an armchair, sat down, and put my feet up. I sipped my drink and listened to her snore and watched her breathe in the feeble light of the clock. I decided to run through all the possibilities, and as I was formulating the first one, daylight smacked me hard in the nose. My hands went up reflexively, and I spilled my drink on my head and hurt my nose more. I wake up hard in the best of times. She was still snoring. I nearly threw the empty glass at her. It was just past noon now. Light came strongly through the heavy curtains, illuminating so much mess and disorder that I could not decide whether she had trashed her bedroom herself or it had been tossed by a pro. I finally settled on the former. The armchair I'd slept on was intact. Or had the pro found what he wanted before he got that far? I gave it up and went to make myself breakfast. The milk was bad, of course, but I found a tolerable egg and makings of an omelet. I don't care for black coffee, but Javanese brewed from frozen beans needs no augmentation. I drank 3 cups. It took me an hour or two to clean up and air out the living room. The cord and transformer went down the oubliette, along with most of the perished items from the fridge. The dishes took 3 full cycles for each load, a couple of hours all told. I passed the time vacuuming and dusting and snooping, learning nothing more of significance. The phone rang. She had no answering program in circuit, of course. I energized the screen. It was a young man in a business tunic wearing the doggedly amiable look of the stranger who wants you to accept the call anyway. After some thought, I did accept, audio only, and let him speak first. He wanted to sell us a marvelous building lot in Forest Acres, South Dakota. I was making up a shopping list about 15 minutes later when I heard her moan. I reached her bedroom door in seconds, waited in the doorway with both hands in sight, and said slowly and clearly, "My name is Joseph Templeton, Karen. I am a friend. You are all right now." Her eyes were those of a small, tormented animal. "Please don't try and get up. Your muscles won't work properly, and you may hurt yourself." No answer. "Karen, are you hungry?"
"Your voice is ugly,"
she said despairingly, and her own voice was so hoarse I winced.
"My voice is ugly,"
she added, and sobbed gently.
"It's all ugly."
She screwed her eyes shut. She was clearly incapable of movement. I told her I would be right back and went to the kitchen. I made up a tray of clear, strong broth, unbuttered toast, tea with maltose, and saltine crackers. She was staring at the ceiling when I got back, and apparently it was vile. I put the tray down, lifted her, and made a backrest of pillows.
"I want a drink."
"After you eat," I said agreeably.
"Who are you?"
"Mother Templeton. Eat."
"The soup, maybe. Not the toast."
She got about half of it down, did nibble at the toast, accepted some tea. I didn't want to overfill her.
"My drink."
"Sure thing." I took the tray back to the kitchen, finished my shopping list, put away the last of the dishes, and put a frozen steak into the oven for my lunch. When I got back, she was fast asleep. Emaciation was near total.
Except for breasts and bloated belly, she was all bone and taut skin. Her pulse was steady. At her best, she would not have been very attractive by conventional standards. Passable. Too much waist, not enough neck, upper legs a bit too thick for the rest of her. It's hard to evaluate a starved and unconscious face, but her jaw was a bit too square, her nose a trifle hooked, her blue eyes just the least little bit too far apart. Animated, the face might have been beautiful. Any set of features can support beauty. But even a superb makeup job could not have made her pretty. There was an old bruise on her chin, another on her left hip. Her hair was sandy blonde, long and thin. It had dried in snarls that would take hours to comb out. Her breasts were magnificent, and that saddened me. In this world, a woman whose breasts are her best feature is in for a rough time. I was putting together a picture of a life that would have depressed anyone with the sensitivity of a rhino. Back when I had first seen her, when her features were alive, she had looked sensitive. Or had that been a trick of the juice? Impossible to say now. But damn it all to hell, I could find nothing to really explain the socket in her skull. You can hear worse life stories in any bar, on any street corner. Wireheads are usually addictive personalities who decide at last to skip the small shit. There were no tracks on her anywhere, no nasal damage, no sign that she used any of the coke she sold. Her work history, pitiful and fragmented as it was too steady for any kind of serious Jones. She had undeniably been hitting the sauce hard lately, but only lately. Tobacco seemed to be her only serious addiction. That left the hypothetical bastard lover. I worked at that for a while to see if I could make it fit. To have done so much psychic damage, he would almost have to have lived with her. But where was his spoor? At that point, I went to the bathroom, and that settled it. When I lifted the seat to urinate, I found written on the underside with magic marker, "It's so nice to have a man around the house." The handwriting was hers. She had lived alone. I was relieved because I hadn't relished thinking about my hypothetical monster or the necessity of tracking and killing him, but I was irritated as hell again. I wanted to understand. For something to do, I took my steak and a mug of coffee to the study and heated up her computer. I tried all the typical access codes, her birth date and her name and numbers and such, but none of them would unlock it. Then, on a hunch, I tried the date of her parents' death, and that did it. I ordered the groceries she needed, instructed the lobby door to accept delivery, and tried everything I could think of to get a diary or a journal out of the damn thing without success. So I punched up the public library and asked the catalog for Britannica on Wireheading. It referred me to Brain Reward, Auto-Stimulus of. I skipped over the history from discovery by Olds and others in 1956 to emergence as a social problem in the late 20th century when surgery got simple. Declined the offered diagrams, graphs, and technical specs. Finally found a brief section on motivations. There was indeed one type of typical user I had overlooked. The terminally ill. Could that really be it? At her age? I went to the bathroom and checked the prescriptions again. Nothing for heavy pain, nothing indicating anything more serious than allergies. Back before telephones had cameras, I might have conned something out of her personal physician, but it would have been a chancy thing even then. There was no way to test the hypothesis. It was possible, even plausible, but it just wasn't likely enough to satisfy the thing inside me that demanded an explanation. I booted a game of four-wall squash and made sure the computer would let me win. I was almost enjoying myself when she screamed. It wasn't much of a scream. Her throat was shot, but it fetched me at once. I saw the problem as I cleared the door. The topical anesthetic had worn off the large sores on her back and buttocks, and the pain had woken her. Now that I thought about it, it should have happened earlier. That spray was only supposed to be good for a few hours. I decided that her pleasure pain system was weakened by overload. The sores were bad. She would have scars. I resprayed them, and her moans stopped nearly at once. I could devise no means of securing her on her belly that would not be nightmare-inducing, and decided it was unnecessary. I thought she was out again and started to leave. Her voice, muffled by pillows, stopped me in my tracks.
"I don't know you. Maybe you're not even real. I can tell you."
"Save your energy, Karen. You..."
"Shut up. You wanted the karma? You got it."
I shut up. Her voice was flat, dead.
"All my friends were dating at 12. He made me wait till 14. Said I couldn't be trusted. Tommy came to take me to the dance, and he gave Tommy a hard time.
I was so embarrassed. The dance was nice for a couple of hours. Then Tommy started chasing after Joe Tompkins. He just left me and went off with her. I went into the ladies' room and cried for a long time. A couple of girls got the story out of me, and one of them had a bottle of vodka in her purse. I never drank before. When I started tearing up cars in the parking lot, one of the girls got a hold of Tommy. She gave him shit and made him take me home. I don't remember it. I found out later. Her throat gave out, and I got water. She accepted it without meeting my eyes, turned her face away, and continued. Tommy got me in the door somehow. I was out cold by then. He'd been fooling around a little with me in the car, I think. He must have been too scared to try to get me upstairs. He left me on the couch and my underpants on the rug and went home. Next thing I knew, I was on the floor and my face hurt. He was standing over me. "Whore," he said. I got up and tried to explain, and he hit me a couple of times. I ran for the door, but he hit me hard in the back. I went into the stairs and banged my head real hard. Feeling began to come into her voice for the first time. The feeling was fear. I dared not move. When I woke up, it was day. Mama must have bandaged my head and put me to bed. My head hurt a lot. When I came out of the bathroom, I heard him call me. Him and Mama were in bed. He started in on me. Wouldn't let me talk, and he kept getting madder and madder. Finally, I hollered back at him. He got up off the bed and started in hitting me again. My robe came off. He kept hitting me in the belly and tits, and his fists were like hammers. "Slut," he kept saying. "Whore." I thought he was going to kill me, so I grabbed one arm and bit. He roared like a dragon and threw me across the room. Under the bed, Mama jumped up, and he pulled down his underpants. It was big, purple. I screamed and screamed and tore at his back, and Mama just stood there. Her eyes were big and round, just like in cartoons. His breath stank, and I screamed and screamed. And she broke off short, and her shoulders nodded. When she continued, her voice was stone dead again. I woke up in my own bed again, took a real long shower, and went downstairs. Mama was making pancakes. I sat down and she gave me one and I ate it, and then I threw it up right there on the table and ran out the door. She never said a word, never called me back. After school that day, I found a sanctuary. I started the divorce proceedings. I never saw either of them again. I never told this to anybody before. The pause was so long, I thought she had fallen asleep. Since that time, I've tried it with men and women and boys and girls in the dark and in the desert sun with people I cared for and people I didn't give a damn about, and I have never understood the pleasure in it. Best it's ever been for me is not uncomfortable. God, how I've wondered. Now I know. She was starting to drift. Only thing my whole life turned out better than cracked up to be. She snorted sleepily. Even alone. I sat there for a long time without moving. My legs trembled when I got up, and my hands trembled while I made supper. That was the last time she was lucid for nearly 48 hours. I plied her with successively stronger soups every time she woke up, and once I got a couple of pieces of tea, soggy toast into her. Sometimes she called me by others' names, and sometimes she didn't know I was there, and everything she said was disjointed. I listened to her CDs, watched some of her video, charged some books and games to her computer account. I took a lot of her aspirin, and drank surprisingly little of her booze. It was frustrating. I still couldn't make it all fit together. There was a large piece missing. The animal who sired and raised her had planted the charge, of course, and I perceived that it was big enough to blow her apart. But why had it taken 8 years to go off? If his death 4 years ago had not triggered it, what had? I could not leave until I knew. Midway through the second day, her plumbing started working again. I had to change the sheets. The next morning, a noise woke me, and I found her on the bathroom floor on her knees in a pool of urine. I got her clean and back to bed, and just as I thought she was going to drift off, she started yelling at me. "Lousy son of a bitch, it could have been over! I'll never have the guts again now! How could you do that, you bastard? It was so nice!" She turned violently away from me and curled up. I had to make a hard choice then, and I gambled on what I knew of loneliness, and sat on the edge of the bed and stroked her hair as gently and impersonally as I knew how. It was a good guess. She began to cry, in great racking heaves first, then the steady wail of total heartbreak. I had been praying for this and did not begrudge the strength it cost her. By the time she fell off the edge into sleep, she had cried for so long that every muscle in my body ached from sitting still. She never felt me get up, stiff and clumsy as I was. There was something different about her sleeping face now. It was not slack, but relaxed. I limped out, feeling as close to peace as I had since I arrived, and as I was passing the living room on the way to the liquor, I heard the phone. As I had before, I looked over the caller. The picture was under-contrasted and snowy. It was a payphone. He looked like an immigrant construction worker, massive and florid and necklace, almost brutish, and at the moment under great stress. He was crushing a hat in his hands, mortally embarrassed. I mentally shrugged and accepted.
"Sharon, don't hang up," he was saying. "I gotta find out what this is all about."
Nothing could have made me hang up.
"Sharon? Sharon, I know you're there. Joanne says you ain't there. She says you called you every day for almost a week and banged on your door a few times, but I know you're there. Now, anyway, I walked past your place an hour ago and I seen the bathroom light go on and off. Sharon, will you please tell me what the hell is going on? Are you listening to me? I know you're listening to me. Look, you gotta understand. I thought it was all set, see? I thought it was set. Arranged. I put it to Joanne because she's my regular and she says not me, lover, but I know a gal. Look, was she lying to me or what? She told me for another bill you play them kind of games sometimes.
Regular $200 bank deposits, plus a cardboard box full of scales, vials, razor, mirror, and milk powder, makes her a coke dealer, right, Travis McGee? Don't be misled by the fact that the box was shoved in a corner sealed with tape and covered with dust. After all, the only other illicit profession that pays regular sums at regular intervals is hooker, and two bills is too much for square-jawed, hook-nosed, wide-eyed little Karen, breasts or no breasts. For a garden-variety hooker.
Damn it, she told me she called you and set it up. She gave me your apartment number.
He shook his head violently.
I can't make no sense out of this. Damn it, she couldn't be lying to me. It don't figure. You let me in, didn't even turn the camera on first. It was all arranged. And then you screamed, and I was real careful not to really hurt you. I know I was. Then I put on my pants, and I'm putting the envelope on the dresser, and you bust that chair on me and come at me with that knife. I had to bust you one. It just don't make no sense. Will you, goddamn it, say something to me? I'm twisted up inside going on 2 weeks now. I can't even eat.
I went to shut off the phone, and my hand was shaking so bad I missed spinning the volume knob to minimum.
Sharon, you gotta believe me, he hollered from far away. I'm into rape fantasy. I'm not into rape.
And then I had found the right switch and he was gone. I got up very slowly and toddled off to the liquor cabinet, and I stood in front of it taking pulls from different bottles at random until I could no longer see his face, his earnest, baffled, half-ashamed face. Because his hair was thin, sandy blonde, and his jaw was a bit too square, and his nose was a trifle hooked, and his blue eyes were just the least little bit too far apart. They say everyone has a double somewhere. And Fate is such a witty little motherfucker, isn't he? I don't remember how I got to bed. I woke later that night with the feeling that I would have to bang my head on the floor a few times to get my heart started again. I was on my makeshift doss of pillows and blankets beside her bed, and when I finally peeled my eyes open, she was sitting up in bed staring at me. She had fixed her hair somehow, and her nails were trimmed. We looked at each other for a long time. Her color was returning somewhat, and the edge was off her bones. She sighed.
What did Joanne say when you told her?
I said nothing.
Come on, Joanne's got the only other key to this place, and she wouldn't give it to you if you weren't a friend, so what did she say?
I got painfully up out of the tangle and walked to the window. A phallic church steeple rose above the low rises a couple blocks away. God is an iron, I said. Did you know that? I turned to look at her and she was staring. She laughed experimentally, stopped when I failed to join in.
And I'm a pair of pants with a hole scorched through the ass?
If a person who indulges in gluttony is a glutton, and a person who commits a felony is a felon, then God is an iron, or else he's the dumbest designer that ever lived. Of 1,000 possible snap reactions, she picked the most flattering and hence most irritating. She kept silent, kept looking at me, and thought about what I had said. At last she said,
I agree. What particular design screw-up did you have in mind?
The one that nearly left you dead in a pile of your own shit, I said harshly. Everybody talks about the new menace, wireheading, eighth most common cause of death in less than a decade. Wireheading's not new. It's just a technical refinement.
I don't follow.
Are you familiar with the old cliche, everything in the world I like is either illegal, immoral, or fattening?
Sure.
Well, didn't that ever strike you as damned odd? What's the most nutritionally useless and physiologically dangerous food substance in the world? White sugar, glucose, and it seems to be beyond the power of the human nervous system to resist it. They put it in virtually all the processed food there is, which is next to all the food there is, because nobody can resist it. And so we poison ourselves and whipsaw our dispositions and rot our teeth. Maltose is just as sweet, but it's less popular precisely because it doesn't kick your blood sugar in the ass and then depress it again. Isn't that odd? There is a primitive programming in our skulls that rewards us, literally overwhelmingly, every time we do something damn silly, like smoke a poison, or eat or drink or snort or shoot a poison, or overeat good foods, or engage in complicated sexual behavior without procreative intent, which, if it were not for the pleasure, would be pointless and insane, and which, if pursued for the pleasure alone, quickly becomes pointless and insane anyway. A suicidal brain reward system is built into us.
But the reward system is for survival.
So how the hell did ours get wired up so that survival-threatening behavior gets rewarded best of all? Even the pro-survival pleasure stimuli are wired so that a dangerous overload produces the maximum pleasure. On a purely biological level, man is programmed to strive hugely for more than he needs, more than he can profitably use. Add in intelligence, and everything goes to hell. Man is capable of outgrowing any ecological niche you put him in. He survives it all because he is the animal that moves. Given half a chance, he kills himself of surfeit. My knees were trembling so badly, I had to sit down. I felt feverish and somehow larger than myself, and I knew I was talking much too fast. She had nothing whatever to say with voice, face, or body. It is illuminating, I went on, fingering my aching nose, to note that the two ultimate refinements of hedonism are the pleasure of cruelty and the pleasure of the despoliation of innocence. Consider, no sane person in search of sheerly physical sexual pleasure would select an inexperienced partner. Everyone knows that mature, experienced lovers are more competent, confident, and skilled. Yet there is not a skin mag in the world that prints pictures of men or women over 20 if they can possibly help it. Don't tell me about recapturing lost youth. The root is that a fantasy object over 20 cannot plausibly possess innocence, can no longer be corrupted. Man has historically devoted much more subtle and ingenious thought to inflicting cruelty than to giving others pleasure, which, given his gregarious nature, would seem a much more survival-oriented behavior. Poll any 100 people at random, and you'll find at least 20 or 30 who know all there is to know about psychological torture and psychic castration, and maybe 2 who know how to give a terrific back rub. That business of your father leaving all his money to the church and leaving you $100 the going rate, that was artistry. I can't imagine a way to make you feel as good as that made you feel rotten. But for him, it must have been pure pleasure.
Maybe the Puritans were right, she said. Maybe pleasure is the root of all evil. Oh, God, but life is bleak without it.
One of my most precious possessions, I went on blindly, is a button that my friend Slinky John used to hand paint and sell below cost. He was the only practicing anarchist I ever met. The button reads, "Go, Lemmings, go." A lemming surely feels intense pleasure as he gallops to the sea. His self-destruction is programmed by nature, a part of the very same life force that insisted on being conceived and born in the first place. If it feels good, do it, I laughed, and she flinched. So it seems to me that God is either an iron or a colossal jackass. I don't know whether to be admiring or contemptuous. All at once I was out of words and out of strength. I yanked my gaze away from hers and stared at my knees for a long time. I felt vaguely ashamed, as befits one who has thrown a tantrum in a sick room. After a time, she said,
"You talk good on your feet."
I kept looking at my knees. I think I used to be an actor once.
I would have guessed...
Hiatus. I was standing by the door, facing out into the hall, and she was still speaking.
I said, "Will you tell me something?"
"If I can."
"What was the pleasure in putting me back together again?"
I flinched.
"Look at me. There. I got a half-ass idea what shape I was in when you met me, and I can guess what it's been like since. I don't know if I'd have done as much for Joanne, and she's my best friend. You don't look like a guy your favorite kick is sick femmes, and you sure as hell don't look like you're so rich you got time on your hands. So what's been your pleasure these last few days? trying to understand, I snapped. I'm nosy.
And do you understand?
Yeah, I put it together.
So you'll be going now.
Not yet, I said automatically. You're not...
And caught myself. There's something else besides pleasure, she said. Another system of reward, only I don't think it has much to do with the one I've got wired up to my scalp here. Not brain reward. Call it mind reward. Call it joy. The thing like pleasure that you feel when you've done a good thing, or passed up a real tempting chance to do a bad thing, or when the unfolding of the universe just seems especially apt. It's nowhere near as flashy and intense as pleasure can be, believe me. But it's got something going for it, something that can make you do without pleasure, even accept a lot of pain to get it. That stuff you're talking about, that's there, that's true. But you said yourself, man is the animal that outgrows and moves. Evolution works slow is all. She pushed hair back from her face. It took a couple of 100 million years to develop a thinking ape, and you want a smart one and a lousy few hundred thou? That lemming drive you're talking about is there. But there's another kind of drive, another kind of force that's working against it, or else there wouldn't still be any people, and there wouldn't be the words to have this conversation, and... She paused and looked down at herself. And I wouldn't be here to say them. Well, that was just random chance. She snorted. What isn't? Oh, well, that's fine, I shouted. That's fine. Since the world is saved and you got everything under control, I'll just be going along. I've got a lot of voice when I yell. She ignored it utterly, continued speaking as if nothing had happened. Now, I can say that I have sampled the spectrum of the pleasure system at both ends, none and all there is, and I think the rest of my life I will dedicate myself to the middle of the road and see how that works out. Starting with the very weak tea and toast I'm going to ask you to bring me in another 10 minutes or so. With maltose. But as for this other stuff, this joy thing, that I would like to begin learning about as much as I can, as soon as I can. I don't really know a goddamn thing about it, but I understand it has something to do with sharing and caring, and what did you say your name was?
It doesn't matter, I yelled.
All right, what can I do for you?
Nothing!
What did you come here for? I was angry enough to be honest.
To burgle your fucking apartment!
Her eyes opened wide, and then she slumped back against the pillows and laughed until the tears came, and I tried and could not help myself and laughed too, and we shared laughter for a long time, as long as we had shared her tears the night before. And then, straight-faced, she said,
"Wait till I'm on my feet. You're going to need help with those stereo speakers.
Butter on the toast."
That was God is an Iron, a.k.a. Chapter 2 of the novel Mind Killer, first of the three novels found in the hardcover omnibus The Lifehouse Trilogy, just out from Bain Books. All right, now, I got some good news, and I got some bad news, and then I'll play you out with a song. The very good news is that Blackstone Audiobooks, noticing all the furor and fuss there's been about Genie's zero-gravity dance adventures these days, the Stardance movie, publicity, etc., and if you don't know what I'm talking about, please go to www.stardancemovie.com and have fun hunting around. Anyway, all the publicity surrounding the Stardance movie has moved Blackstone to finally get around to scheduling the entire Stardance trilogy, which I recorded sometime back, has been in a can for a while, waiting for the right time to schedule, I guess. Anyway, they've now picked it. Stardance will be out in April, Starseed will be out in May, and Starmind will be out in June, the three books that among them constitute the Stardance trilogy. They will, believe me, sound much better than this podcast because they are recorded not here in my office at Tottering on the Brink or my PowerBook, but in Rob Bailey's Treehouse Studio on Bowen Island, an extraordinary facility with state-of-the-art Mac gear and just some... he's the man. With him around to edit and run the boards and watch the mics, I know I'm coming off good. Me, I'm sitting here faking it. Doing my best. For the real quality stuff, you want to go Blackstone Audio Books, blackstoneaudio.com, www.blackstoneaudio.com, and place your orders now for April Stardance, May Starseed, and June Starmind. That's the good news. The not-so-good news. Jeannie sat down earlier this evening and ran the numbers for me. I've been doing this podcast now for 28 weeks, and... We worked out what I've taken in donations and how many hours it took to produce those 28 podcasts. And without going into details, the bottom line is I'm working for approximately $2 an hour here.
I frankly was a little more optimistic than that when I started all this. I've been really, really enjoying doing this podcasting. I can't tell you how much I've been enjoying it. It's been something I've looked forward to every week. It's something I'd like to continue to look forward to every week. But I just can't value my time at $2 an hour. I got a family to support. I got books to write. I got deadlines to meet. If that's as much enthusiasm as there is for this podcast, and if no advertisers spring forward who would like to be brought to the world by Spider Robinson, then sometime after the 30th podcast, I'm going to have to start seriously rethinking this. And what it is I'm going to have to start psychologically preparing myself for the fact that I just can't keep indulging myself this way. So if you guys really are grooving on this podcast, kick in a few bucks in donations, tell your friends. It'll really help a lot because I'm out here without a net. And I'd appreciate it. Even $10 would make a difference. To make donations, you just go to www.spiderrobinson.com/podcast.html. There should be a little button there that will allow you to drop in a few bucks or even to subscribe if you care to. I can promise you that if you do keep this sucker going, I haven't even begun to tap my reservoirs of amazing music that you probably never heard yet. I got tons more stuff backed up, not just by folks I brought you already, like Breeze Cahill and Crosby and Nash and Raymond and P-Bar. I got stuff coming by Janis Ian you haven't heard yet, some Seth Augustus stuff, some Andrew York tunes, I want to talk a little bit about Alex Gray. I got more musicians you don't know yet that you really need to know about than you could possibly imagine. I got Jake Thackeray coming, one of the greatest songwriters that ever lived. I got Lord Buckley for you. I got tons of stuff. I just wrote the liner notes for Daryl Scott's next album, Modern Hymns. I'd really love to bring you a track or two from that. I got Ray Charles tracks nobody's heard yet. I got a 2-hour recording of the late, great Lenny Bro giving a guy a private guitar lesson in his living room with an impromptu concert in between. I mean, I got incredible stuff I'd really love to bring you. Help me out. Okay, the end of the hour approaches, so I'm going to have to cut the third of the 4 songs I promised you tonight from my CD. However, you can get the entire thing in CD quality in a jewel box with some terrific cover art, some liner notes, and the very first reading I ever did of my own work on record, the chapter 1 of Callahan's Key. All you got to do is go to http://spiderrobinson.com/music.html and you will find out how you can order the whole CD from Indie Pool for $20 Canadian, whatever that works out to in U.S. money these days, I do not know. Here now, however, is the final song from the album and the title song. Unmistakably, it was written for my genie while she was away at the Zen monastery. I started to write her a love song and realized I'd written her so many I'd kind of run out of new ways to say I love you. And finally it dawned on me that wasn't a problem, that was a creative challenge, and I created a song called Belaboring the Obvious.
I want to tell you how I feel, love, oh, but it will not come as news. I got no secrets to reveal, love, but I'm gonna say it anyway, cause I'm alone and you're away. I haven't got a blessed thing to lose. So here goes. Water ain't dry, the sky goes up high, and a booger makes a mighty poor glue. You can't herd cats, bacteria don't wear hats, and sugar ain't sour, it gets damp in the shower. Murder's not a nice thing to do. Trees got wood, bucking is pretty good, and I love you. I am belaboring the obvious. You will have noticed all the time. This is as practical an exercise is taping 20 cents to my transmission, so that anytime I want to, I can shift my paradigm. But God knows, goats don't vote, and an iron don't float, and a hippie don't turn down boom. That's true. Dog bites man, the teacher don't understand, and I love you.
This sucks. Must be nice to have bucks. And the player on first base is named who?
Kids grew up, most fellas pee standing up. And I love you. I guess I didn't need to say. It's just this message that my heart says. And I kinda like the way it's more redundant than was absolutely necessary, according to the Department of Redundancy Department.
Bureau of Unnecessary Repetition and Pointless Redundancy.
I must close.
Fun is nice.
You can't fry ice. And the money will always be through. You know that bullshit stinks. And no one else, it's the Sphinx. And I love you.
Our mama living ain't bad. God knows, dying is sad.
And little we know is true.
Oh, but that's just karma.
Baby, you can bet the bomb on this.
God knows that's true. Listen, one happy announcement at press time I'll leave you with. Editor Robin F. Witten of Audiophile Magazine was kind enough to send me today a beautiful gold-chased scroll identifying me as the winner of Audiophile's Earphones Award for Excellence for my audiobook reading of Variable Star by Robert A. Heinlein and Spider Robinson, narrated by Spider Robinson, Blackstone Audiobooks. That is way cool. I am going to have this framed with great, great, great glee and pleasure. I know Robert and Ginny would both be tickled pink by this. Thank you very much, Robin Witten, for passing on the news. I intend to look into Audiophile Magazine, with which I confess I was until today unfamiliar. I suspect that's going to change real quick. Anyway, great news. If I'm winning awards for this audiobook crap, folks, maybe we ought to keep this going. And Blackstone Audio can't use up my output. So throw a few bucks in the hat. We'll see you next week. Meanwhile, let's go try and make somebody else smile.